from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The U.S. private prison system incarcerates about 126,000 people and provides beds for 65% of immigrant detentions. In her new book, Inside Private Prisons, Lauren Brooke Eisen lays out the history of these prisons, including how they burgeoned during the 1980s tough-on-crime trend, and she joins us for this segment to discuss her book and why she thinks private prisons need more oversight and what can be done to improve on opaque prison industrial complex. Welcome, Lauren Eisen.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Good to have you here today. And we're also talking about private prisons being represented to the tune of about $35 million in lobbying. That's according to the Washington Post since 1989. I mean, this is big business.
This is big business. And the two largest private prison corporations, CoreCivic and GEO Group, the two that are publicly traded on the stock exchange, earned about $4.5 billion in 2016 in revenue. So we are talking a big business. And those are just two of the many corporations that manage and own private prisons and private immigration detention centers.
Those are two of the big ones, of course, and you certainly highlight them in your work. But private prisons were in trouble a while back. They were a growth industry, and then they seem to be in trouble. Now with Donald Trump, they seem to be back. In fact, CNBC described Donald Trump as a game changer for the industry.
You're exactly right. About 18 months ago, people thought that the private prison industry was going to be put out of business by the Obama administration. And today, the Trump administration has been a godsend for the industry. In the summer of 2016, the Obama administration announced that it would end the Justice Department's reliance on private prisons at the federal level. And as soon as Attorney General Sessions took home at the Justice Department, he reversed that Obama-era guidance. And today, we've seen the stocks of CoreCivic and GEO Group recover from the summer of 2016. And we've also seen new ground breaking for private prisons across the country. And specifically, and I think really important and a harbinger of things to come, the 2018 Trump administration budget calls for new spending to the tune of $1.2 billion to increase immigration detention capacity in this country. And that's going to be a direct boon for the private prison industry.
Now, when I mentioned the profit in this industry, it's up to about $5 billion, but 2.6 of that is the two companies we mentioned, CoreCivic and GEO Group. You know, you put a lot of emphasis on the privatization of penitentiaries and prisons and so forth, and yet, you know, we've got problems. And I want to talk about reform with you because you actually spell out, it seems to me, some very necessary reforms. But we need reform to a profound degree in regular prisons that are, you know, state controlled or controlled by government.
Absolutely. And the book notes that our recidivism rate in the U.S. is about two-thirds. And what that means is that about two-thirds of individuals who leave prison in America return within 3 years. Those are lousy recidivism rates. So we have to improve the conditions of confinement. We have to improve our programming, our reentry
services. That's
across
the board, private as well.
That's private, public, and the book talks about that. But specifically, we can hold these corporations' feet to the fire. And we, as a country, 4 decades after the private prison industry emerged, we've never asked these corporations to beat the government's lousy recidivism rates. So we have these corporations making huge profits, and we've never said to them, you have to improve your programming. You have to improve your conditions of confinement. You know what? You have to beat the government's lousy recidivism rate if you're going to get this contract. And that's what this book calls for.
Well, whether they're private or public, they're not exactly concentrating on rehabilitation or on the kinds of things that we saw. There were some real advances in Pennsylvania reducing recidivism, and it was done largely because of, I think the figure was by 11.3%, largely because of job training, education programs, cognitive behavior therapy, and substance abuse work. So these kind of comprehensive programs have to some extent gone by the wayside, and the real problem with the political climate is not great now either, I ought to add. But the real problem with these private prisons is there's no way to track the recidivism.
Well, and the book notes that there is a way to track recidivism rates. And ironically,
it's not being tracked. You're proposing a way to track.
It's not being tracked, yeah. Exactly. And that's because the government's never asked these corporations to track recidivism rates. But I use Pennsylvania as an example because what they did in Pennsylvania is they saw that the the corporations that owned and managed these halfway houses where incarcerated individuals may go in transition, you know, soon before they're about to be released into the community, they saw that the recidivism rates were terrible in those halfway houses. So they said to those corporations, you know what, if you don't improve your recidivism rates, we're going to take away your contracts. And the recidivism rates were actually reduced as soon as Pennsylvania's Department of Corrections started to rewrite those contracts. So I think that's a model that can be imported to how corrections works when we talk about these contracts with private corporations that own and manage and operate prisons.
Yeah, you talk a lot about rewriting the contracts and maybe being more concerned about performance-based contracts as opposed to how many beds are there, although this is of concern, certainly. But I'm also wondering, you say if they're here to stay, let's improve them. Let's make them better. And there's a good deal of ways that this can be done. And I was struck by some that you suggested or recommended. To begin with, visits, not visits that are told ahead of time, but just drop-in visits. Surprise
Absolutely.
Visits.
Surprise visits. And I interviewed a lot of the monitors across the country who monitor these private prisons and state prisons. And I was struck that so many of the monitors make appointments ahead of time. They'll call ahead and they'll say, I'll be at the prison in 2 days. And that's not the proper way to monitor whether it's government prisons or private prisons. These monitors need to show up unannounced. So the corrections officers, you know, everyone can't get ready. And so they can see what it's really like behind bars in these prisons. And that's a suggestion that I make in the book. And additionally, the press, family members, people should just be able to show up and visit prisons. They shouldn't have to call ahead. It shouldn't be so difficult. And, you know, I, as a journalist, in writing this book, had a very difficult time visiting these private prisons and private immigration detention centers. And one of the recommendations I make in the book is that transparency and accountability needs to be much improved in this country when we allow these corporations to own and manage prisons and immigration detention centers.
Well, we're talking also about, and it's kind of a shocking statistic, about 70% of ICE detainees are in private detention centers.
Yes, and that's what a lot of people don't know, that almost 70% of detainees held by the Department of Homeland Security are housed in privately run facilities. And that's why the Trump administration's increasing reliance on the private prison industry it is worrisome. And then that's why the Trump administration's bent towards more immigration enforcement and harsher sentencing laws and draconian policies that detain more undocumented individuals behind bars is a direct line to profits for these private prison corporations.
It's been a big boon to business, to their business, but still we have almost no oversight in how we're going to move into the realm. I'm talking about private as well as public prisons. Into that realm of it's kind of difficult. Let me actually bring our listeners into this. I know people have strong sentiments about this. And let me give out the phone number because you can join us in this conversation. We do welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or post any questions or comments you have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum. California's private prisons?
California relies on private prisons to a great extent. And what a lot of your listeners may not be aware of is that about 5,000 incarcerated individuals are behind bars in private prisons in the state. But another, a little more than 4,000 individuals are behind bars in private prisons out of the state. They're in prisons in Mississippi and in Arizona. And, you know, one of the reasons, one of the ways that California was able to comply with the Supreme Court order in 2011 to reduce its prison population was by relying on the private prisons to start to reduce their prison populations. And those numbers that I just gave you, they don't include the number of undocumented individuals who are behind bars in California's private immigration detention centers. So it's certainly a state that has relied on this industry to house and care for so many of its incarcerated individuals.
Let's go far away from California for just a moment, because Australia has been a really good example of, well, serious reform, and let's talk about what they're doing. And they're doing a lot of things right.
I'm glad that you brought that up. So there are prisons in Australia and in New Zealand where the corporations that manage and own those prisons are paid more money if they can reduce the recidivism rate better than the government can. And I scoured the country as I was writing the book for that type of innovation, and I didn't see it with any private prison contracts. And we are starting to see these contracts in Australia and New Zealand, and it'll be really interesting to see if they're successful, right? That, you know, can you incentivize these corporations to reduce recidivism more than the government can? And is that a model that we should be following in the U.S.?
Do you know what the I think I said earlier, we're talking about maybe a total percentage of inmate prison population in private prisons, and it's a growing population number. Yeah,
it is. So today we have about 130,000 individuals who are in private prisons across the United States. We have about 8% of our state incarcerated population in private prisons. At the federal level, it's closer to about 20%. And this is across 28 states and includes the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Additionally, we talked about how about 65 to 70% of detainees held by the Department of Homeland Security are also in these privately run facilities. And that is certainly going to grow under the Trump administration.
Well, we need litigation and legislation. And legislation in this political climate and with the Trump administration is going to be difficult. So a lot comes down to litigation, doesn't it?
It does. And there are a lot of tools to improve transparency and accountability in the private prison industry. And litigation is certainly one, because of the discovery, and you know, we need journalists to file open records requests. And something that I write about in the book is that at the federal level, private prisons are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act requests, and at the state level, private prisons in most of the states in this country are not subject to the same open records requests that government prisons are. And that's something that we can change through legislation. That's something that, you know, ordinary, you know, everyday constituents can call their policymakers, they can call their governors, they can call their state legislators and try to reform their state legislation to really ensure that these corporations are subject to the same open records request, you know, the same compliance that government prisons are required to comply with.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking with Lauren Brooke Eisen about her new book, Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma. In the Age of Mass Incarceration, she's senior counsel with the Brennan Center's Justice Program at New York University School of Law. And speaking of law, there was a recent Supreme Court decision against blocking freedom of information about immigrant detainees. Now, how is this affecting things in your judgment?
There was a recent Supreme Court opinion, and it was a really interesting case because it sort of weaved its way up through the courts, and some advocacy organizations had filed some freedom of information requests, and they weren't able to get access to this information. And we'll see, you know, what happens. I mean, I think this is precedent that a lot of federal courts will now need to follow. But again, it's going to be, you know, a state by state, sort of court by court decision on how they follow this case and whether they do grant these Freedom of Information Act requests to the individuals that are requiring, you know, that are asking for this information. And I think really relevant to your listeners also is that on January 1st, California became the first state in the country to apply open records requests laws to the private prison corporations when it comes to immigration detention. And so California is certainly leading the way in terms of allowing for more access and transparency in these private immigration detention facilities that are really a black box.
So, you know, I can tell you, with all the programs we've done on the need for prison reform, that the needs are just as great in the state prisons. I mean, they're understaffed, they're overcrowded, they don't have the transparency in many instances, the same kinds of problems. So are state prisons the answer to the kind of problems that you're raising in your book about private prisons?
So the book looks at the difference between state, you know, government prisons and these private prisons, and you know, there are some government-run prisons and jails. I mean, I live in New York City where, you know, Rikers Island is, you know, a few miles away. And, you know, that jail is, you know, one of the worst jails in the country. And that's a government facility. So we have a lot of problems with sexual assaults, you know, terrible conditions of confinement in prisons across the country and jails across the country, whether they're public or whether they're private. But this book focuses on the intersection of profit and incarceration and, you know, asks the question, what does it mean that we've relied for so many years on these corporations to manage and care for so many individuals behind their bars? And how have we let these corporations sort of slide by and not innovate, not improve the conditions of confinement. And yes, this is a problem that we have with prisons. It's not just a private prison issue. But the book asks the questions, you know, can we ask these corporations to lead the way to innovate in a way that the government never has?
Again, we're talking to Laura Brooke Eisen, and she is senior counsel with Brennan Center's Justice Program at New York University School of Law, author of Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarcerations. I want to go right to your calls and emails. And again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Can I ask you before we go to calls and emails about if you know about Jared Kushner's prison reform plan or whether it has any impact on private prisons?
So this is a positive first step for an administration that has been reluctant to embrace any attempt at criminal justice reform, despite bipartisan consensus that we incarcerate far too many Americans. However, it is out of step from a president who so far has largely supported these draconian crime policies that contribute to mass incarceration. But we're certainly excited about this renewed focus on reforming the criminal justice system. And we look forward to seeing real concrete action out of this administration, such as passing major criminal justice reform, like the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. That would be a significant way and to start chipping away at mass incarceration in this country. So we're hopeful, but we're hoping that we see action, not just talk.
Well, I don't know. Kushner had a father who was incarcerated, and Kushner is also supposed to be solving our Middle East problem. We'll have to, I guess, wait and see with bated breath. But let me read a comment from Noel, who says, let's thank Jeff Sessions for reversing Obama's directive to stop using private prisons for immigration jails. And let's bring our callers on here. And let's go first to you, Andrea. Good morning. Andrea, are you there?
Possibly you meant Andrew.
Oh, I'm sorry. Andrew, go ahead. I didn't mean to change your gender there. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Aside from that, I'm an attorney who was a prison administrator in Illinois for 7 years. And the whole concept of private prisons is just abhorrent. A lot of people don't realize the excess that can go on in private prisons. I haven't read your book, but I certainly intend to. My question is, does the state of California specifically, and generally other states, do they extend sovereign immunity to private prisons so that they can commit whatever, you know, problems, you know, or abuses of inmates and get off scot-free? And I'm glad that you talked about the Freedom of Information Act issue, because California has its own version of the FOIA law. So that can be corrected.
But you raised a very important question, Andrew, because a lot of these private prisons don't come under state law. Isn't that right, Laura?
Yes, and that is a really great question. So there is no sovereign immunity for these private prisons. What individuals who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated can do is they can sue the private prison themselves. They can sue the Department of Corrections. They can sue the Federal Bureau of Prisons. But it gets complicated, right? Because the reality of the situation is the corrections officers at these prisons are private employees. They're not state employees. And so that's why litigation is an incredibly useful tool, because you can sue these corporations for, you know, egregious human rights violations or violations of conditions of confinement.
Let me thank Andrew for the call. Actually, Peter brings up another point here. He writes, one area of abuse is the shameless coercion of private phone companies extracting big profits from collect calls to people on the outside. It makes it very difficult to communicate with inmates. And Susan writes, there is no reason for our private prisons to do anything to reduce recidivism. They make their money by filling beds. Their state contracts generally guarantee the percent of beds that will be filled. That number is generally around 90%. Their incentive is to do their best to make sure they come back. And we'll go to more of our callers. Let me go next to you. William, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is whether true reform can only be had through just outright banning private prisons, because like the previous comment said, it's an industry meant for profit, and the more prisoners they have, the more money they make. Therefore, they have no desire to reduce recidivism or any just lack of locking up people in the first place. So my question is, would outright banning of this industry be the true answer?
So I'm really glad you asked that question because that's something I struggled and wrestled with as I was writing this book. And I spoke to a lot of advocates who feel passionately that, you know, there is no place for the private prison industry in this country. But the book takes the view that given the political realities that, you know, President Trump and Attorney General Sessions and this administration are going to continue to rely on the private prison industry, you know, in the meantime, thousands of people are cycling in and out of these private prisons and private immigration detention centers every day. And we owe it to them. We owe a duty to them to improve their lives and their conditions of confinement. And I acknowledge that even asking these questions about how to reform the industry has worrying moral ramifications. If, as a matter of principle, it's wrong to profit from punishment, anything short of abolition, including proposing important reforms, does risk complicity with what some say is an indefensible industry. But I think it is important to reform the industry. And, you know, at the heart of reforming the industry is the incentives. And so we need to flip the incentives. And, you know, one of the other callers mentioned, well, they're paid per incarcerated individual, right? This is how they make money. But we need to change those incentives, and we need to look at Australia and New Zealand, and we need to say, okay, if you're going to be in this business, then you get paid more if you reduce recidivism. You get paid more if the individuals leaving your facility get jobs and stay in their jobs. And we need to look at the outcomes, and we need to reward better outcomes if we're really serious about public safety and reducing recidivism in this country.
We were talking before, though, just a moment ago, and let me thank William for his call. And in the time remaining, if you'd like to join us, it's 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. Because they're not under the same state laws, the result is incentivizing cover-ups, isn't it? I mean, to put it bluntly.
Well, that's something that I write about in the book as well. Now, there are a lot of incentives in the public sector and in the private sector that could incentivize bad behavior. So this is not necessarily a public versus private prison issue. But when we talk about incentives, it's profit at the end of the day, and it's getting these new contracts. So what we want to do is we want to incentivize the owners and managers of these prisons to ensure that they do produce better outcomes. And we want to incentivize more programming, better programming, more targeted programming, reduced recidivism rates. And
it's just really establishing metrics, really.
It's establishing metrics, but it's also rewarding those metrics. And it's something that we can start to do and innovate with the private sector, as we've seen other countries do. And given that private prisons have been around since the mid-1980s, you know, when I write about this in the book, they sort of emerged and established themselves and grew their footprint without this great national debate. And partly that's because at the time, about two-thirds of states were under some sort of federal court order to reduce their prison populations. So they turned to the private prison industry to, you know, outsource and delegate this responsibility. But now that we're having these bipartisan conversations about criminal justice reform and reducing prison populations, we really need to start thinking about how we rely on the private prison industry. And changing the incentives is a really significant way to reform the industry.
Do you encounter, though, and I wonder to what extent this plays into the stalling on reform or the slowness of reform, and it's not just the present administration. It's been true for a long time. There's an attitude, these people are locked up. They deserve to be locked up. Why should we be concerned about them? Why should we care about them? I mean, there are a lot of Americans, genuinely decent, good people, hardworking people who feel that way.
There are a lot of Americans with that attitude, but that attitude sort of flies in the face of public safety. It flies in the face of morality and improving communities. You know, so many people have a relative who's incarcerated in this country. Sesame Street just added a character, Alex the Muppet, whose father is incarcerated because so many American children grow up with a parent who's behind bars or a parent who used to be behind bars. And we need to understand that more prison does not make us safer. In fact, over the last decade, about, you know, more than half of the states were able to reduce imprisonment and crime. And there are, you know, decades of research at this point indicating that prison is something called criminogenic, right? It actually makes us less safe because people
makes it better for better criminals.
Well, but when people go to prison, they're not being treated for, you know, the reason they might have committed a crime in the first place. They're not getting drug treatment, mental health treatment, which in most cases is why someone may have committed a crime. People are going to prison and they're not receiving education. They're not receiving programming. And we need to have treatment. We need to send individuals to, accountability courts, drug treatment courts, provide mental health treatment, and really get at the drivers of why some may commit a crime in the first place, and not send people, you know, to rural areas miles away from their families and their support systems for many years. You know, we're such a punitive nation. We send people to prison longer than, you know, most countries on this planet. We have 2.2 million people behind bars in this country, more than any other country on the planet. And it's not making us safer.
Facebook comment from a listener, actually a question from a listener. How specifically are corporations profiting from private prisons, and what are the primary corporations that own these facilities? Now, we've touched on this, but we just mentioned the two. And we probably ought to mention the fact that I think private prisons are only in 29 of the 50 states. Is that correct?
So private prisons are across 29 states. However, the federal government also uses private prisons, and so they are in they own and manage federal prisons across states that the federal government—
In all states.
In many states. And then there's also federal immigration detention centers as well. And they tend to be in Texas, California, and Arizona. However, something that's really interesting your listeners might not be aware of is that in an unprecedented move over just a couple of months ago, Immigration and Customs Enforcement asked for information from contractors who can provide additional immigration detention space in the interior of the nation, in major cities such as Salt Lake City, Chicago, Detroit, and St. Paul. And that's an indication of where this administration is going, that they're hoping to increase immigration detention in the interior of the country. And that's significant for the profit of these corporations, because individuals who are detained in immigration detention centers in the interior of the country are detained for longer periods of time because they tend to have ties to the community. They tend to be more established. So we need to be very aware of where this administration is going and, understand that we're going to see more of a reliance on the private prison industry.
We only have seconds left here, but let me get David has something to say about moral obligation, take care of prisoners. David, unfortunately, you're going to have to say it quickly, please.
Yeah, I just think privatizing is wrong. And I think as a society, if we're willing to incarcerate people, we have a moral obligation to do it ethically, morally, and do it right.
Okay, well said. And thank you for that. And thank you, Lauren Brooke Eisen. Good to have you aboard with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Congratulations on your book, and keep up the good work. Lauren Brooke Eisen is senior counsel with the Brennan Center's Justice Program at NYU School of Law. The book, again, is Inside Private Prisons, an American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I thank you for being with us and remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. For all of us at Forum, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.